Okay, so the Russian Revolution remains, of course, one of the most contested events in history. And this is for obvious reasons, because our side won. And a lot of that contestation is focused on Lenin and the Bolsheviks. So how and why did they come about? What did they stand for? To what extent were they in the same tradition as, or a departure from, the dominant trends of the international socialist movement at the time? And why did they oppose World War I and lead a revolution where others capitulated to the ruling class and went over to the other side? And some of this, I think, can be addressed by looking at the split in the Russian socialist movement after 1903, which gave rise to the Bolsheviks, and the long subsequent struggle by Lenin and his comrades against Menshevism. And as with any political tendency, the Bolsheviks were not formed in a vacuum, but out of constant rivalry with their opponents, who sought to influence and lead the Russian workers' movement as well, but in a different direction. And it's only with the victory of the Bolsheviks over the Mensheviks to influence in the working class that allowed the successful seizure of power by the Soviets in 1917. Now, the Bolshevik-Menshevik split is also the origin of many of the familiar claims by opponents of the Russian Revolution that... is my screen sharing thing not working?
Yeah, can you click present, maybe?
Where was I? In this historic moment. Yeah, as I was saying, so some of this can all be addressed by looking at the split in the Russian socialist movement after 1903. The Bolsheviks are not formed out of a vacuum, and it was their victory over the Mensheviks that allowed the successful seizure of power in October 1917. And I was just saying, like, the Bolshevik-Menshevik split is also the origin of lots of the familiar claims that Lenin supposedly was obsessed with top-down centralism and party rules at the expense of the self-activity of workers, and therefore he was some kind of forerunner to Stalinism. And the Stalinists themselves support this narrative, but they put a positive twist on it, arguing that the all-knowing Lenin built a party on the supposedly key principle of democratic centralism, by which they mean bureaucratic top-down centralism. Okay, on the other hand, the influential Canadian historian Lars Lee defends Lenin's commitment to democracy and to mass working class struggle, but does so while seriously playing down and depoliticizing the significance of the split with the Mensheviks. And this is part of his overall argument that Lenin never, supposedly, consciously or unconsciously, broke from the approach of Karl Kautsky and the German SPD. And this latter argument by people like Lars Lee is used today by some kind of ex-revolutionaries turned reformists like Eric Blanc, who's today a prominent member of the Democratic Socialists of America and a cheerleader of Bernie Sanders. And his argument, expressed in a recent Jacobin article, is that if you like the Russian Revolution, then today you should join the Democrats and campaign for Bernie Sanders and even for Joe Biden. Okay, so what really happened with the Bolshevik-Menshevik split? Well, I'd argue that it should be understood as part of the long fight by Russian revolutionary Marxists against various liberal or reformist currents on the left. And so Lenin, in 1907, had this to say. He said, I quote, "In casting a retrospective glance at the struggle of the two trends in Russian Marxism and social democracy during the last 12 years, from 1895 to 1907, one cannot avoid the conclusion that so-called legal Marxism, economism, and Menshevism are diverse forms of one and the same historical tendency." And I'll go on to explain what those are in a minute. But let's look at this period, which forms the background, actually, to the 1903 Second Congress of the Russian Social Democratic Labour Party, which is where the Bolshevik-Menshevik split began. Okay, so a bit of background to that conference. Congress. Well, firstly, there had been a first Congress of the Russian Social Democratic Labour Party, the RSDLP, which had been held in 1898. But it was a very abortive affair. It brought together just 9 delegates, who had very divergent views on the way forward for Russian socialism, and 5 of them had been arrested within a month. And this pretty much sums up the state of Marxist organization in Russia at the time. Under conditions of severe repression, a multitude of tiny, largely atomized Marxist circles of petty bourgeois intellectuals and students and workers proliferated, and they were heroic, but they were constantly broken up by arrests and prison and exile. And on top of this, the RSDLP manifesto at this first Congress was written by a guy called Peter Struve. And he's a bit of a case study in what I'll go on to talk about, because he was one of those Russian Marxists, supposedly, who Lenin would soon be polemicizing against as really a bourgeois liberal, just employing some Marxist verbiage. And their version of Marxism had very little to do with workers' revolution and socialism, and mainly emphasized that the development of capitalism was both inevitable and progressive against their neurotic populist opponents who were determined to cling on to the idea of the peasant commune being the basis for a future socialist society. And later in life, Struve explained, "Socialism, to tell you the truth, never aroused the slightest emotion in me, still less attraction." Not exactly the guy you want writing your socialist manifesto. And Struve would soon become a leading advocate of the interwoven currents known as legal Marxism, economism, and revisionism. Okay, so what were these currents? Essentially, they were the right-wing, compromising wing of the socialist movement. They were influenced by the arguments of Edward Bernstein in Germany, who at this time was revising Marxism to argue for a parliamentary road to socialism instead of class struggle and revolution. Now, in Russia, of course, there was no parliament. There was just czarism. So Russian reformism had to take different forms. Some constrained themselves to the very limited publishing activities and ideas legally allowed by the czar, hence the term legal Marxism. But this also overlapped with the trend called economism, which essentially was about limiting the kinds of demands and arguments being put to socialists, being put by socialists to the working class, in particular, pretty much shutting up about the demand to overthrow czarism. So the political demands were very much downplayed. And this became theorized and justified by the economists by saying that the workers were, you know, much more interested in bread and butter demands anyway, you know, and that through struggling for these, they would at some point inevitably come into conflict with the czar. So socialists didn't really need to talk about that stuff. And the effect of all of this was to leave the working class politically subordinate to the bourgeois liberals. And following this to its logical conclusion, Peter Struve would actually go on to co-found the party of the liberal bourgeoisie, the Cadets, in 1905. Okay, so the growth of the revisionist trends in Russia in the late 1890s was a key part of what spurred Lenin and Martov and others, who were at this time the leaders of the St. Petersburg League of Struggle, to take up the fight to build a proper Russian party. And especially at that time, because as well, there was real growth and combativity of the Russian proletariat going on in the late 1890s, and the growth of those Marxist circles that I talked about, which were having more and more influence over the proletariat and their struggles. Okay, so Lenin and Martov came together with the key leaders of the old guard of Russian Marxism, who were in the Emancipation of Labor group, and Plekhanov in particular, and together they founded the newspaper Iskra in 1900. And the editorial board of Iskra was made up of Lenin, Plekhanov, Martov, Zasilich, Axelrod, and Potrasov. And the latter five would all go on to become leading members of the Mensheviks. But at this time, they were more or less united. Now, Iskra was not just a newspaper, but it was an organizing center. And its whole task was to argue for Marxist politics, to polemicize against economism and revisionism, to argue for the creation of a stable, centralized Russian Marxist party, and to prepare for this task by creating networks of Iskra agents throughout Russia and uniting as many of the Marxist circles and committees as they could behind this perspective. And the Iskra outlook was summarized in Lenin's 1901 book, What is to be Done, which it's important to note was totally uncontroversial at this time among the Iskra editors, including, as I said, all the future Menshevik leaders. And the 1903 Congress was really the culmination of all of these efforts of the Iskra group. They initiated and planned the Congress, and by now had either established or had won over a whole number of the Russian underground Marxist circles, giving them a seemingly solid three-fifths majority of Congress delegates at the 1903 Congress. Now, the other two-fifths of the delegates were made up of people from the Jewish Socialist Union, the Bund, and the Rebbetzin Delo group, who were much more sympathetic to economism. And there was also a kind of vacillating centrist swamp group between the economists and the Iskraists. Okay, so the seemingly guaranteed aim of the Iskraists was to use their clear majority at this Congress to establish Iskraist perspective and leadership as that of the newly formed or newly kind of reformed RSDLP. And so the split that occurred was not primarily between the Iskraists and the rest, That split was kind of taken for granted, with the anti-Iskra minority expected to either, you know, democratically submit to the majority decisions of the Congress and form a loyal opposition within the party, or to walk out and leave the party, which is what the Bund and the kind of economist sympathizers did, not unexpectedly. And so the key split at the Congress, which was actually amongst the Iskra group itself, and it occurred over two main questions. So the first was the question of the definition of a party member. And Lenin's formulation was that a party member had to be someone who actually participated in one of the party's organizations. Whereas Martov argued for a broad, much looser formulation, that it could be anyone who assisted the party under the direction of one of its organizations. Okay, now at one point, Martov argued, for example, and I quote, "The more widespread the title of party member, the better. We could only rejoice if every striker, every demonstrator answering for his actions could proclaim himself a party member." Now, this is really an absurd position which reduces membership to utter meaninglessness and is based on, and was based on, a real confusion which conflated the working class with the party, with the Socialist Party. So there was a whole debate that went on, but Plekhanov really sharpened the debate the most, arguing for Lenin's formulation. And he argued, quote, "The truth lies with Lenin. Intellectuals may hesitate for individualistic reasons to join the party, so much the better, for they are generally opportunists. For this reason, if no other, the opponents of opportunism should vote for Lenin's draft." But Martov's formulation won the vote, and he won that with the backers, with his backers within Iskra, but also with the anti-Iskra, more right-wing delegates at the Congress. Okay, now the second and much more bitter dispute was over the election of the editorial board of Iskra. But the acrimony of this debate can't be understood without understanding the division in the Iskra camp that had been opened up by the dispute over party membership. Now, when it came to the editorial board, Lenin and Plekhanov at this time and the other Bolsheviks argued now that the RSDLP had been formed as a proper party and Iskra had been elected as its official organ. It followed naturally that the Iskra editors could no longer just function as some self-appointed group, but must be elected by the Congress. And they put forward a slate of Lenin, Plekhanov, and Martov, the three editors who had already been doing the overwhelming bulk of the work running Iskra. And in response to this, Martov and the future Mensheviks put up an enormous hue and cry, with their core argument being that this was incredibly mean to the old editors, Axelrod, Zasulich and Potrasov, and that to elect a different editorial board amounted to a vote of no confidence in these old heroes of Russian Marxism and a personal insult, and that this showed, supposedly, that Lenin was determined to preside over a so-called state of siege in the party. Now, by now, the Bund and the economists had walked out of the conference over other issues, which gave Lenin's slate of three a majority. Martov, though, refused to take up his elected post, and following the Congress, the furious campaign waged by the Martovouts, who now embrace the label of Mensheviks, which just means minority, to paint this majority decision of the Congress as a nasty dictatorship of Lenin, who was responsible, supposedly, for splitting the party through his all-round meanness and obsession with centralization and lack of flexibility. They demanded that the old editorial board be restored. Okay, we must be clear, though, that it was not Lenin who actually drove the split immediately after the 1903 Congress. In fact, him and Plekhanov tried to make concessions to the minority to prevent it and to smooth things over, but the minority refused. But the behaviour of the Mensheviks over the subsequent months and their determination to undermine the leading bodies elected by the Congress and to make the split a matter of principle, and their newfound softness on the more right-wing elements like the economists, hardened Lenin's approach over the subsequent months. Okay, so how do we make sense of all this? Well, Lenin, I think, summed it up very well in his analysis of the Congress, One Step Forward, Two Steps Back, which he wrote in 1904. And he described the dispute over party membership like this, and I quote, he says, "The minor mistake committed by Comrade Martov and Comrade Axelrod was and might have remained a minor one until it became the starting point for a durable alliance between them and the whole opportunist wing of our party." And he goes on to say, "Taken by itself, there was nothing dreadful, nor critical, nor even anything abnormal in the fact that the Congress and the party divided into a left and a right, a revolutionary and an opportunist wing. On the contrary, the whole past history, past decade in the history of the Russian, and not only the Russian, social democratic movement had been leading inevitably and inexorably to such a division. Okay, and this is the crux of the whole thing. Because the precise question over which the split took place is not really what matters. The point is, a split into revolutionary and opportunist wings, or into hards and softs, as the people often referred to them, was inevitable. And now it had taken place. And pretty soon the actual disputes at the Congress itself faded into the background. The Mensheviks, for example, even unanimously adopted Lenin's definition of party membership in 1906, you know, this thing that had given rise to a huge row. But the split between Bolsheviks and Mensheviks remained. Now, opportunists rarely declare their opportunism openly. And so instead, the Mensheviks created a whole scandal about Lenin's so-called hyper-centralism, and they quickly enlisted their friends in the international socialist movement to back them up. And this was the context in which some, including Plekhanov, who by now had jumped ship over to the Mensheviks, began to attack Lenin's pamphlet, What Is to Be Done, despite earlier supporting and defending it. And Leon Trotsky and Rosa Luxemburg joined in this campaign, I've got to say. And this is despite later actually being much closer to Lenin on, you know, most of the substantial political questions of revolution versus reform and so on. And thus, the Mensheviks took over Iskra again, you know, due to the flipping over of Plekhanov. Okay, so it's out of these Menshevik polemics, as I said earlier, that many of the caricatures of Lenin that we still hear today were born. And you just need to read some of Lenin's replies to see how ridiculous all this stuff is. For example, in Luxemburg's polemic against Lenin, she accuses him of being an ultra-centralist and a Jacobin. And Lenin is at great pains to point out that all he's arguing is that when an official party congress is held, the majority should get to elect its leading organs, which should actually reflect the majority view of the Congress and of the party, not of the minority. This is what Lenin is being denounced for. And one of their clearest takes on the split was actually written 35 years later by a leading Menshevik, Theodor Dan. And he wrote, and I quote, "The organizational disagreements that at the Second Congress divided the Iskra people into Bolsheviks and Mensheviks were merely the cover for incipient intellectual and political divergences. It was not an organizational, but a political divergence." Okay, and this is not to say that the question of party membership and so on is irrelevant. Clearly, Lenin's conception is correct, and it's the only feasible one for a revolutionary party, which has to be a part of the working class and has to strive to lead the rest of the class, but can only ever itself encapsulate a minority of its most class-conscious elements. So, you know, those questions are important, but this organizational approach flowed from a political approach, both of which were at odds with the direction the Mensheviks were headed. Okay, and pretty soon the Mensheviks were making this whole political divergence clear over their, really their entire approach to politics and the class struggle in Russia. Because the Mensheviks adopted the stance from 1904, really, that the fight against Tsarism and for political liberty must and would be led by the Russian bourgeoisie and their liberal representatives. And in the words of Axelrod, they show themselves to be our allies. And sure, he conceded, the bourgeois liberals would be inclined to vacillate, but that's why, and I quote, "our attitude to the liberal bourgeoisie is defined by the task of imbuing it with more courage." Now, furthermore, he said, "the working class would be falling into a fateful blunder if it pushed too hard to assert its demands independently of these bourgeois liberals, since it would only cause them to recoil from the struggle and force them into the camp of reaction." Okay, now this line was a fundamental break from the previous stance of Iskra, and indeed from the lessons that Marx and Engels had drawn following the revolutions of 1848. They had concluded then that ever since the emergence of the proletariat as a class capable of acting in its own interests, the bourgeoisie could no longer play a progressive role, even in a fight against the remnants of the feudal absolutist order which impeded its own progress. And this was a lesson that Lenin had imbued to his core and applied to Russia. And so in his wonderful pamphlet, Two Tactics of Social Democracy, Lenin really bludgeoned the Menshevik line and everything that it entailed. The Russian bourgeoisie, the industrialists, the bankers, and the landowners were weak, were dependent on Tsarism, were tied to it by a thousand threads, and far more terrified of the mass of workers and peasants than they were determined to end absolutism. So the Menshevik line was a return of economism. It meant abandoning the leadership of the whole struggle to the bourgeois liberals, who in turn would capitulate and do a deal with the Tsar. The Bolshevik argument instead was that only the working class would fight uncompromisingly for the democratic revolution, that it had to be organisationally independent of the treacherous bourgeoisie, but also politically independent. And that meant fighting for leadership of the struggle against Tsarism and taking it all the way. The working class would find allies in this struggle, but not amongst the bourgeoisie. Instead, they would be found amongst the mass of Russian peasants who shared a common enemy and whose struggles for land and against tyranny would bring them into conflict with Tsarism and the capitalist landowners alongside the workers. And so Lenin argued the only form the democratic revolution in Russia could take, if it was to be successful, was the democratic dictatorship of the proletariat and the peasantry. And this was Lenin's meaning of hegemony, a crucial concept for him. Okay, now we know the deep significance of this divergence, you know, if we fast forward to 1917, whereas the Mensheviks remained loyal defenders of the bourgeois provisional government, even to the point of supporting the slaughter of the First World War and holding back all the demands of workers and peasants, the Bolsheviks instead led a revolution that put the Soviets into power. Okay, but in 1905, this future was unknown, and the Bolsheviks still actually believed that the coming revolution would be limited to carrying out democratic tasks, but still within a capitalist framework, which would, Lenin argued, in the short term, actually strengthen the bourgeoisie. Now, this confusion and the full extent to which the Mensheviks would, you know, go over to the other side in future was not totally clear to Lenin or the Bolsheviks at this point. And so, you know, even while Lenin is like savagely polemicizing against the Mensheviks and arguing that, for example, he says at one point, quote, that the Mensheviks should not be admitted to any membership in any organization of our party. But at the same time, Lenin did actually leave open that at some point the force of events would prove the revolutionary line adopted by the Bolsheviks correct, and that the bulk of the opportunists would be compelled to learn their lesson, and maybe the party could in fact be reunited. Now, added to this was the fact that the Bolsheviks could clearly win over whole sections of the Mensheviks, not the emigres and the intellectuals really, but the workers in Russia, as they did in huge numbers in 1917. And added to this was the fact that Lenin was constantly having to wage an argument against sections of the Bolsheviks themselves that wanted to conciliate with the Mensheviks. And briefly in 1905, the Mensheviks, or sections of them anyway, shifted to the left under the weight of this, you know, massive workers' revolution. They allowed themselves to be swept up in the times, in which they would soon go on to regret. But this led to the so-called Unity Congress in 1906, although neither faction ever actually dissolved, and the moment was very short-lived, because following the defeat of the 1905 revolution and the subsequent lurch to the right of the bourgeois liberals and intellectuals, the Mensheviks also took a hard turn to the right. And as I said, they quickly disowned their momentary radical intoxication. And the period of reaction saw the Mensheviks come under the sway of what's known as liquidationism, which is really, in many ways, the return of legal Marxism. You know, the argument that trying to maintain an underground organization at all was redundant, and instead socialists should just adapt themselves to operating through the various legal avenues, try and get yourself some position in some shitty bureaucracy, and so on. But this meant dropping all revolutionary or even Republican anti-Tsarist demands. And after all, this was a time when even the party of the liberal bourgeoisie, the cadets, was illegal. That's how repressive Tsarism was. Okay, nevertheless, the fact that Lenin and the Bolsheviks didn't definitively close off the possibility of unity, and that they, in a very technical sense, remained just a faction of the same party as the Mensheviks, has been used by some to downplay the significance of the split at all. Or to argue that, in fact, they never really did split, or that Lenin was supposedly for building broad parties, and so on. So this is the argument that Lars Lee makes, which I'll come back to now, because it's, you know, been quite influential on the left. And it raises the whole question, really, of what are the lessons we should take from the Bolsheviks? Now, Lars Lee's analysis of the Bolshevik-Menshevik split is that, and I quote, both Mensheviks and Bolsheviks were solid Eferchians, by which he means loyal to kind of the Kautskyan program of the German SPD, But the Mensheviks were typically skeptical about actual developments, and the Bolsheviks typically sanguine. So that's what he reduces the split to, really. And then Lenin rediscovered his big book, he writes that the real debate was over whether the model of Overtianism could be applied at all to Russia, and if so, to what extent. The debate over these questions was essentially an empirical one, a political judgment about what was and was not feasible in Russia. So his basic argument is that the Bolsheviks were more confident about workers and the Mensheviks were less confident. Now, of course, there's a grain of truth to this. After all, it's true that a difference in confidence in workers' ability to make a revolution and run the world might lead some to reformism and others to revolutionary politics. But to leave it at that is, you know, really to really miss the full political logic of what these parties stood for. Because the Mensheviks didn't just lack confidence in the workers, they had confidence in the bourgeoisie, and they were desperate to gain that confidence by holding back the workers. And this is, of course, the logic of reformism that's played out again and again. As Luxemburg famously wrote, it's not just a different road to the same goal, it's a totally different goal. And in this case, it led to supporting the First World War, as I said, and opposing Soviet power. Now, Lars Lee's central claim is that Lenin never broke from the orthodoxy of the Second International, embodied in Karl Kautsky and the German SPD. And this claim rests partly on Lee's argument that Kautsky was the overwhelming influence on Lenin's Marxism. This is a claim which I think has been challenged very convincingly by August Nimtz, who spoke at our conference yesterday, who documents how, in fact, Lenin had a very deep understanding of the works of Marx and Engels themselves and drew his chief lessons directly from them, not via Kautsky. And Nimtz also documents how Lenin was acutely aware of the problem of opportunism in the German party. He'd read, for example, Engels' critique of a draft of the Erfurt program, and he'd even sent it to Plekhanov when Plekhanov was drafting the program for the RSDLP back in 1903. And Lenin had also experienced, actually, firsthand the opportunism of the German party, both from his attendance at conferences of the Second International and from the fact that the leaders of the Second International, including Kautsky, constantly sided with the Mensheviks against the Bolsheviks, even when the Bolsheviks had won a clear majority of working class support, both in 1907 and again later on in 1912 and 13. So while it's true that Lenin wasn't 100% clear on just how rotten the SPD was and Kautsky's full role in that until the First World War, it's not the case at all, really, that Lenin was just some uncritical Erfurtian. And more to the point is what Lenin actually did in Russia, because his practice was completely different to that of Kautsky. Kautsky spent his entire political career propping up the centre of the SPD and making peace between the left and the right. He was a master of fudging questions, coming up with formulations that dodged the key issue and tried to placate everybody. Much more so, in fact, than the open right winger of the SPD, who was Bernstein, Kautsky played a major role in covering up the reformist reality of the SPD with Marx's verbiage and preventing clarity and stymieing the development of a genuinely revolutionary socialist organization in Germany. Kautsky bears great responsibility for the failure of any significant section of the SPD to oppose the First World War and for the ultimate crushing of the German Revolution. Now, how does this record compare with Lenin and the Bolsheviks? It's night and day. Lenin spent his entire life fighting, exposing, and defeating the Russian Kautskys, i.e. the Mensheviks. And of course, he was massively aided in this by all the objective differences which made reformism in Russia so much weaker than in Western Europe. But that doesn't detract from the crucial subjective role played by Lenin and the Bolsheviks. And, you know, despite the technicality of the Bolsheviks and Mensheviks both being in the RSDLP, the Bolsheviks and Mensheviks from 1904 onwards were two separate organizations. They had separate memberships, separate leaderships, separate publications, and separate political orientations. And this doesn't mean they were hermetically sealed off from one another, of course, and the Bolsheviks, displayed great tactical flexibility, depending on the situation, in working with the Mensheviks and winning them over, arguing with them and so on. But this separation was vital in clarifying the difference between a revolutionary and a reformist or opportunist approach to politics in the eyes of the working class. The Bolsheviks were then able to build a clear, hard organization of revolutionaries, which ultimately was able to outgrow and defeat the broad Mensheviks. And this is precisely what was not done in other parties of the Second International, tragically. Okay, and at the 1912 Congress, and I'll have to pretty much wind up the story here, As the class struggle was recovering from the depths of the counter-revolution, the Bolsheviks consolidated their forces, and they largely completed the split with the Mensheviks in 1912. There they launched Pravda, and they launched their election campaign for the Fourth Duma, where Bolshevik candidates ran separately and openly opposed to Menshevik candidates. And this was one of the things that really carried through to the split that had gone on to wider and wider layers of the working class. And the Bolsheviks won a big majority of the proletariat in those fights against the Mensheviks in the 1912 elections, which was a sign of their growing influence in the working class and the weakness of the Mensheviks by this point. Okay, so I'll leave the story there, but I'll wind up with a quote from a cop, from the police director in Russia, because it's a really lovely summary of the previous 10 years and of where the Bolsheviks have come to by this point. So this cop says, during the past 10 years, the most energetic, courageous elements capable of tireless struggle, resistance, and constant organization have been the organizations and persons concentrating around Lenin. The faction of Leninists is always better organized than the others, stronger in its singleness of purpose, more resourceful in propagating its ideas among the workers. And when, during the last 2 years, the labor movement began to grow stronger, Lenin and his followers came closer to the workers than the others, and he was the first to proclaim purely revolutionary slogans. And I'll leave it there.